Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagelani-Alba. We are so excited to be joining you this month. We're going to have a really interesting conversation, and we're going to get a chance to touch on some topics that fall outside of both Christopher and I's expertise, but not outside our interests. I don't want to waste too much time here up at the top with my voice because we are so excited to talk to our guest today. So please, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
My name is Neeti Bhan. I am currently pursuing a part-time study in transdisciplinary innovation at Aalto University, interestingly in the School of Engineering under the Mechanical Engineering Department. That can be a topic that we can discuss some other time. I'll just give a brief introduction to my background. I came back to university after 30 years of professional practice, the last 15 of which have primarily been in the informal economies of what is variously known as the global south or the developing countries or the bottom of the pyramid. I've heard all of these names over the past 15 years. In the field, I have led teams in conducting multidisciplinary exploratory fieldwork, exploratory research using a variety of methods, looking at understanding people, their context, their conditions, their challenges, from the perspective of informing product development, innovation, new products, services, and particularly for the informal sector, business models. The last 5 to 10 years have put me mostly in the East African community. But of course, with the pandemic, the last 3 years I've been here in Helsinki.
Welcome and thank you so much, Neeti. It's a real pleasure to have you on here, and we're really grateful to have you on. You and I have spoken outside of this, and I know that you have such an interesting and, you know, expansive background. So I guess, how did you get into this sort of work, especially, you know, because of engineering background? Not to sound like, you know, social science ignorant, but don't usually think of engineers going into this sort of stuff. So, I mean, how did you get there?
The engineering degree, I guess, is more because I'm Indian, and that's what we all study. But I would situate myself more as a designer. I went straight after my engineering degree for my first graduate program in product design at the National Institute of Design in Ahmedabad, 1989. And from a long, convoluted journey that led me to Chicago at the Institute of Design at the turn of the century, 2002, I ended up in staff. I was director of graduate admissions and recruiting, everything to do with student services and admissions. But at the same time, I was taking classes because that's what had brought me to the program. What sets Chicago apart, and this is really the story of how I ended up doing what I'm doing now, is that with one of their deans, Jay Doblin, they pioneered a methods-oriented approach to structured innovation planning. So it's not so much jump in, spaghetti on the wall, let's figure out what's going on, but more like, let's figure out what's going on. What is this novel domain that we need to bring something novel into? So there's a lot of unknowns, a lot of uncertainties. Can we use tools from social sciences and various humanities, meaning things like design ethnography, user interviews, in-depth observations, surveys, a lot of activity oriented towards the aim of, can we understand people in the context of their own lives, the way they live, operate, act, and do their thing, in order for us to get insights that can help inform our own product development strategies or novel innovations. This was the original conceptualization of human-centered design particularly human-centered design planning. Again, it's a field that has gotten some new names. The most recent, I think, is innovation planning. But broadly speaking, what it does is, let's take an exemplar African market or an African context because of our topic or area of interest. Let's say solar power. So solar power for off-grid residents who are most likely to be in rural, they're most likely to have irregular and unpredictable cash flows because they could be farmers or they could be people in other supporting activities in a village, in a primarily agricultural area. Incomes are seasonal, incomes are irregular. We can't make the same assumptions that we would make, for example, if we were launching a new kind of a lamp here in Helsinki or even in Chicago, where people have access to things like a credit card or to a regular paycheck or to a bank account, things that allow you to make purchases differently, to think about what kind of a product, the whole consumer market or the way marketing is done, it's different. There's data on consumer insights, there's data on product sales, there's data from retail. None of this is available if we want to, say, launch a solar-powered product or a kit or whatever. So we're starting from scratch and asking questions like, what is their existing energy consumption behavior? Or what's our competition? Are they using candles? Are they using lanterns? What are the energy sources? What are they doing for cooking? What are they doing for lighting? So this is almost like context setting. So I'm flipping back and forth between example content and process, right? That I'm asking questions that sets, that helps me create a landscape of the operating environment within which, say, if my client was a solar power product manufacturer, would be introducing their new product or service or business model, or in the case of these emerging markets or frontier markets, whatever the word may be used. That's why we take a holistic multidisciplinary approach, because it's not just product. It's also how you're going to pay for it and how much should it be priced at. It's also how is it going to be distributed. It's also what's the demand like. So the question is almost, I need to understand who am I talking to? Why would they want something? What do they need before we can even begin to think about what we would make for them? How would we get it to them? And how would we purchase them? Answering the question on how did I end up doing this work in Africa, I would definitely like to introduce someone that there are listeners who may have heard of him and his work from about 15 to 20 years ago. It was a chap called Jan Chipchase who worked for Nokia. He literally introduced the idea to Nokia of exploratory user research. So user research as a part of design research has tended to focus on users' interaction and responses to a particular product or a service or a business model, where ideas have tended to already be conceptualized even at low fidelity levels. But with Nokia's first forays into emerging markets at the turn of the century, at one level, they had to explore what this new operating environment was like in order to even understand what was going on with mobile phones. Now, they may not be the pioneers, because I know Intel's teams, Microsoft teams, so just around the turn of the century, As global emerging markets, particularly India and China, were first opening up before Africa and the other markets, technology companies, digitalization companies, software, whether it was Microsoft Teams in Bengaluru, whether it was Intel directly looking at what people were doing with technology, expanded beyond their domestic markets or the developed country markets into these wholly new unknown markets. So fieldwork, research expanded. You couldn't really have either A, a hypothesis, or B, focus on narrowly framed questions. The second trend was product development started getting so much more complex for these type of products, technology embedded products or digitalization and mobile telephony products, that teams expanded from single disciplines or say technology only into technologists and social scientists working with anthropologists and designers and visualizers. So it's led to far more interdisciplinary teams, far more broader focus. So there was this period of expansion. It's almost like now this has narrowed in a little because of the level of understanding that you can have a team working on products because there's layers of product. So we're going back almost like 25 years ago when all of this was exploding, we didn't know enough, and even the technology was new. So it was a very particularly fertile time. This is also the time when design started capturing interest of the business press. So there was a lot of things happening, let's say 1998 to about 2005, globally, you know, technology-wise, product-wise, market-wise, new markets, and new ways to think about people, how to design for them, how to innovate, how to introduce new products. In that context, I think we can all agree that Nokia was a groundbreaking organization with regard to the way their products made an immense difference in the world. Now, it's my own personal area of interest that this did not happen by just a device. We take it for granted that products now come packaged with a business model, with a payment plan. But the first, for example, where a complete package emerged is the iPod, because they were already MP3 players. The iPod is a great case study of bringing business design and engineering together, because you've got a very, very attractive product that's desirability, taken care of by design, right? Air quotes included. And then you've got the technology, which isn't new at that point, you know, but you've got a flash drive and you've got an MP3 player. But what you've also, and that's the feasibility. So this product can be made. But what you've also got is viability coming into play, because you've got a 99-cent download from this iTunes. When you put viability, feasibility, desirability together, you've got what they call the sweet spot of innovation. This is why there's such a big push for let's bring business design and engineering together to innovate. For example, the university where I'm at right now, Aalto, it exists. It may not say so, but these are the trends that led to its emergence, bringing business design and engineering together, if I say so myself. So, again, coming back to the question, I have an engineering degree, but I have an MBA from the University of Pittsburgh that looks at strategies for new markets. And I've got human-centered design and an industrial design background. and particularly in design planning, which is before we can make something, we need to know who are we making it for, what are we making, how much should it cost, or what is its price range? Answering all these questions before we can jump in is what I've kind of been doing. So one, that's how engineering led to this task. Two, Nokia's Jan Chipchase had a blog in the early 2000s that would show us all this cool stuff happening all over Africa. He showed us hackers in Accra making dual SIM phones before any manufacturer had made a dual SIM phone. They had hacked this solution. He showed us, and this is his TED Talk from 2006 or 7, how in Uganda, people were sending money home from the city by calling up the local mobile prepaid airtime sales guy. So you have a voucher or a scratch card to top up your prepaid mobile. And they would call up the local guy in their mother's village and say, okay, guy, if I update your phone with 20 shillings worth of airtime, how much would you give my mother? So these things ended up becoming regularized. They called it sente. I'm citing Chipchase's TED Talk directly here. And the guy would hand over, 18 bob or whatever it was, keeping that small commission for this. So all of these human activities, these innovative activities with the device that Chipchase and his team documented, you can see the seeds of entire services and directions, almost like subsectors, fintech, mobile transfer, mobile money, dual SIM phones. Everything emerges from the way people were already using these. So understanding what people are doing is the richest source of innovation that any organization can look for. I wanted to be part of that, and I got lucky. 2007, Samsung woke up and said, we need to do this, but the only guys who are doing it work for Nokia. So they reached out to an Italian firm, Experientia, and said, we need to know what's going on in Africa. And long story short, Experientia tapped into me to say, could you go to the field and help us inspire and inform Samsung? What is the lower 75% by income population, the lower two-thirds of income, not the top end? What are they doing? Who are they? How do they use phones? November 2007 is when this project got kicked off. We went to the field in January. That's a separate story in its own right, that we were originally supposed to go to Kenya, which was already catching global attention because they're an early adopter nation. M-Pesa was launched in 2007. So, of course, we all wanted to know more about it. But we all know what happened with the post-election violence. So almost in the last minute after all our travel plans were made, we had to pivot. And we did field work in South Africa to replace Kenya because one of our team members was from South Africa. So on short notice, he was able to do this. We sampled Senegal and South Africa. And that project opened my eyes.
Wow. I had no idea that mobile phones had such a big impact on this coming together of interdisciplinary design and manufacturing and all that. I mean, obviously, I remember, for example, when the iPod came out, but I didn't know that there was kind of so much behind it. So I have a couple questions, and I'm going to ask them together. But did you actually work for Nokia? That's my first question. And then my second question is it Nokia that brought you here to Finland directly, or, this kind of involvement with the mobile phones, or did you come through some other path?
Multidisciplinarity, interdisciplinarity, as it's known as, or multi in my case, if we get into the nuances of distinguishing between multi and inter and transdisciplinarity. But bringing down the barriers between disciplines as a means for innovation is what brought me to Finland. It brought me to Finland the first time, it brought me to Finland the second time, and it brought me back to Finland forever. And it directly relates to my current dissertation work. So I think, given all these overlaps, talking a little bit about bringing down barriers to disciplines is a relevant beginning point to answer all the questions. Allow me to put on my, oh God, I am so old at 2007. As I mentioned earlier, I was in Chicago and I was working for the Institute of Design. Just as a note, the Institute of Design is also known as the New Bauhaus. Laszlo Moholy-Nagy founded it in the 40s in Chicago after leaving the Bauhaus in Germany. So those are its roots. So a certain amount of transgressing disciplinary boundaries has always been there. And also my own educational background, because my exposure to business design and engineering had occurred both prior to, on one level, prior to joining Chicago and prior to coming to Finland. And at the turn of the century, around 2005, 2006, there was a lot of talk in industry. So, because my background is as a practitioner, maybe I'll be talking a little bit more about industry than academia, but there was a lot of talk in industry about design and the role that design could play for innovation, for change, for transformation. And you guys may have heard of the popular term design thinking, for example. So all of these things were popping up around this time. At this time, I was focusing on the overlap between business and design. That's where I began my design authorship or design writing career. I was part of Core 77's Cloggers community, which is a industrial design community, who were posting to the Core 77 front page blog, because before its recent, like in the last 5 years, formalization of its publication, the community members posted directly to the front page. It was crowdsourced information. That's how it began. And my particular area was business and design. This is long because it relates to the fact that the UK's Design Council was commissioned or tasked by the Treasury, Sir George Cox. It's called the Cox Europe Mission, to go on a mission to look at multidisciplinary creativity in higher education and business in Finland, Denmark, and the Netherlands in September 2007. So I think it was July or August, because of my work, because of my activities in the community, blogging, a lot of what we would now call digital social networking, but those platforms didn't exist back then. People I knew at the UK Design Council reached out to me and asked me if I would like to join their mission of academics and scholars off on this study trip. So I said yes. So how I got to Finland wasn't through Nokia or mobile phones, but we visited extremely curated, intense 10 days of visits of very early transdisciplinary, multidisciplinary innovation work happening in Holland, TU Eindhoven, Philips, all names, in Denmark, Aarhus University in Denmark. And then in Finland, of course, we visited the School of Art and Design in Arabia, and we visited the product development program in Otaniemi, which was under the Helsinki University of Technology. So bottom line is, we saw all this stuff, and I'm sitting there with this bunch of academics in a classroom in Arabia at the School of Art and Design, and Irio Sotama, who was then the rector, said, well, to all of you, remember all my colleagues there, 30 of us are academics from all over UK in cutting edge design. We are planning to create this, they called it University of Innovation or Innovation University back then. That's the only name they had. They said, we are going to merge the Helsinki School of Economics with the Helsinki University of Technology with the School of Art and Design and bring it all together. And I put up my hand and I said, well, are you going to build a prototype of it? Because, you know, that's what designers and engineers do. You can't just think about this theoretically. You have to build it, kick the tires and see if it would work. And apparently one guy spoke up immediately and he goes, yes, yes, we're building it. So the following year, I came for a conference on, again, as we said, what used to be called the bottom of the pyramid, and sustainability in bottom of the pyramid by the business school, Helsinki School of Economics. This was in September 2008. And a gentleman came up to me from Otaniemi, Anssi Tulemaki, and he talked to us about building this prototype that they had just built. It was called the Design Factory. Aalto didn't have a name yet, where they brought business design and engineering together. So he brought me and the head of sustainability, design and sustainability for Philips. He brought us for a tour. It was after hours, so nobody was really there. But he showed us the building on the campus that was the rough prototype of how do we bring barriers down between disciplines? How do we add researchers, startups, companies, all the different disciplines for innovation? That was when I turned to Anssi and said, I want to work here. How do I come here? And he said, well, if you can find a project that funds you, the doors are open for you. So in a friendly after dinner conversation with a professor at Helsinki School of Economics that evening, I was talking about my 5Ds framework. I can bring it up later. But at the point where we bring design and development together, and I was offered a Tutkija position for a project that they were planning to do under broadly the overlap of sustainability, innovation, and the forest cluster in bottom of pyramid. So even though it was a program based in the School of Economics, the first thing I asked them was, do I have to be based here? They said no. And the first thing I wrote to Anssi was, can I be based there? So, of course, the building is going to be demolished now. The story is over. It's done its job. It was an original prototype to test. That's what the job of a prototype is. Can we make this work? You know, once you can make it work, once multidisciplinary thinking permeates through programs and courses and whatever it is you want it to permeate through. Looking back, I think none of us say, oh no, we shouldn't bring, you know, four different disciplines together, or what's the role between arts and engineering and the social sciences? We don't even question these things anymore. So I think it's done its job. I mean, there are areas to be explored, which is what I'm doing.
Wow, thank you so much. I knew a bit about this history, like that Aalto was like this combination of universities, but it's really interesting to hear like these behind the scenes things and this impetus behind this bringing together that became Aalto. But one of the things that you brought up in what you just mentioned was this 5Ds framework. Would you mind like unpacking that a bit for us and our listeners.
You know, Christopher, I would never mind unpacking that for you and your listeners. So, first is the original article, which has been cited here, there, and wherever, was on the Core 77 Design Magazine site. And I'll probably have to find better citations for it. But so I make a note here before I dive into it that it was written almost 15 years ago when C.K. Prahlad's framing of the bottom of the pyramid was trending in top of mind. Today we recognize that none of us are the bottom of anything. And such a hierarchical framework with regard to socio and economic situations, as well as disparities in operating environment and infrastructures, doesn't help us. So rather than choose between a variety of perhaps better known, but each problematic labels, particularly since I would approach them from a decolonial former other perspective, I can't help but, you know, push back at each of these. Can I just call them the prepaid economy? The reason is because where in Finland, maybe 85 to 90%, that exact percentage changes year to year, or it could be even much higher. I'll have to look up this year's data from the GSMA, the Mobile Manufacturers Association. But if we're 90 or 95% of Finland's mobile phone users would be on a postpaid plan or a subscription plan with a monthly bill that comes after the fact, 95% on average and between 90 to 97% distributed across the 55 countries of the African continent, just as an example, are on the prepaid business model. That is, they purchase micro amounts, micro vouchers, they're called airtime vouchers, loads, top-ups. Each region has its own preferred name. But this fractionalization of the mobile service is what has allowed for and helped accelerate the adoption of mobile telephony amongst populations with no discernible cash flow source, no salary paperwork, no credit rating, no credit cards or formal financial tools. So purchasing in advance is really what opened the doors to this. That whole story is the basis of my past work. So I don't open that here and come to your specific question. The 5Ds emerged as an attempt to look at the role to articulate that holistic approach to these unknown markets that I mentioned in my introductory comments, you know, when I first started talking about what I was doing, where we didn't know how do people live, you know, what are their business models, or what kind of ways could we get them to purchase something? What is their economy? You know, what is the viability, feasibility, desirability of their operating environment if we are to innovate for them? So this holistic approach required us to look at more than just development, more than just design. It needed to look at multiple things at multiple levels, and that's what this framework attempts to answer. So for those in the lower income, the convention, and again, this is something I might want to push back in the future, but I'm talking about stuff developed 15 years ago. The idea was that if we innovate for people who are amongst the lowest socioeconomic strata, we should be looking at something that helps develop. Again, that in itself is a questionable word, so, but that improves their life. You know, there was a certain altruistic mindset associated with innovation when it looked at people who weren't the traditional target audience for innovation. That might be the broadest, least politicized way to say this. So we begin by saying, okay, development, that is your motivator or your imperative. That's why you want to innovate something. You don't know what this something is, but you know what, whatever it is, you're choosing this target audience, the former bottom of the pyramid, in the people in the lower socioeconomic strata from yourself, some way to improve their social and or economic conditions. So that's the first D. But that's not enough. Simply wanting to do that doesn't help you if your product is not suited for them. So you bring in a second D, which is design, for which you need to understand their conditions. I'll give you an example. This is not related to development, but it is related to the challenges of people sitting in developing country contexts, building products for emerging markets, and also the reason why mobile companies like Nokia went out there and invested so much in understanding. Whirlpool made a washing machine for India and other emerging markets, but it was designed in their Brazil emerging market unit. In Brazil, people don't tend to wear lengths of cloth, so they never tested the machine with lengths of cloth. The machine failed in India right after launch because 90% of the clothing thrown in is just lengths of cloth, which would get trapped between the drum of the washing machine and that part that rotates, the rotator. The lengths of cloths would get trapped there. So sometimes it can be just simple things like this. I put it as the next D in the framework. So you've got development. Fine, you know, you set a goal, you move to the next step. How do I get there? I want to get there through design, but who am I designing for? How am I designing? Then it's not enough to have the world's best design product if it's nowhere near what the people whom you're targeting it at, where they shop, how they shop, where they live. So distribution is the next issue that we need to look at if we want a holistic solution, right? I'll give you an example. Back to solar power, because those are some of the most classic ones. Everybody thinks they can design a wonderful solar power product, and they can. But distribution, and there'll be other examples, but distribution is one of the areas where this has failed, for example, because when it comes to distribution, most of the developing world are former colonies who have a legacy of extremely centralized infrastructures and systems for everything, you know, whether it's distribution of internal services, but also the way distribution takes place of products, of services, of things brought in. Things come into a central point and then they're redistributed around the country. So solar power manufacturer goes in, the fastest, easiest way to distribute his product is amazingly through electrical supply contractors and tying up with battery manufacturers and electrical product people, because there's a dearth, that's logical, right? Except that the people who don't have electricity and who live in off-grid areas do not tend to go shopping to an electrical supply shop, do they? So there's a gap. You've got this excellent distribution network, but the people who are living off-grid, it's not a shop they actually frequent, nor do they know that there are products there that can be used without electricity. I'm simplifying a very complex issue here, but these are the challenges I've documented and observed for clients. So distribution is something that needs to be thought about. Who are the actual customers? So instead of thinking of what's convenient for you, you need to think about, meaning everything goes from, why do we call it human-centered design or user-centered design? Where are your end users? Where's your target audience? How do they shop? Where do they shop? What do they buy? What do they need? Which comes to the next question, demand. Demand creation. And very, very few well-meaning social innovation, development-oriented, impact-oriented products. If you look at their websites, and I've done this, I've analyzed them, you'll see that they're talking to their funders and they're talking to their donors. They're not talking to their clients and they don't see them as clients, they're beneficiaries. But at the same time, they want these to be hybrid products to be sold even at a subsidized price to this audience. But this audience now all have smartphones. And so they look you up and they see all you're doing is talking to donors about all these poor Africans without electricity, coughing away on kerosene, right? Instead of telling them why your solar panel kit is good for my house. Basics of marketing. Demand creation. So I call it D because it's a nice, D style framework, but demand creation. And the same thing I've looked at, I've interviewed, fine, people without off-grid do come to the electrical supply shop, we found out, to buy battery-powered lanterns, to buy lanterns and lamps that they get charged elsewhere. And then you have a charge that remains for, 18 hours of use, whatever. There are a lot of solutions. So that's the other thing, is these shops, again, have a limited amount of cash flow. They're in small towns, in rural places. He's going to stock what he sees there's a demand for. He's not the one who's going to invest effort and money into creating a demand for your product. That's your job. But if people come to him saying, hey, do you have brand X's light? Yeah. Or he thinks there's a demand for it. Let me go stock some. But if you don't do any of these things, you do what brand X does, which is find a bunch of donor-funded NGOs to buy your product, because there's not a single customer who would buy them for these various reasons, with all due respect to brands. So we've got development, design, distribution, demand, all of which need to be there. And finally, or rather say foremost, but I put it as finally, you come to dignity. None of this is going to work without the people at the center. So again, the choice of dignity is because it's a D. Maybe I'm coming at it from human-centered design and saying, where are the people? You're too busy talking to everybody else. Where's the recognition? Where's the respect? Which boils down to dignity, right? I'm not your beneficiary. You're not doing me any favors. I'm your customer. In any other socioeconomic strata, the customer is king. Why is it for the ones who have the least amount of disposable income is the situation with the least amount of care and consideration to give them a choice which fits their wallet and needs right? Sorry, I'll stop here because it's a rant.
And it's such an interesting room. I mean, there's so many different avenues to walk down here, but thank you very much for walking us through those 5 Ds. You know, I'm really interested because you've done all this work over a quite long period of time, you know, sounds like more than 15 years. How did this get you to the research that you're doing in your dissertation?
I think again, my answer would be that perhaps because I'm from a field that's a abductive rather than deductive or inductive, and perhaps because I've always worked at the front end, which is we have no idea and have no existing data, and what data we do is so dominated by donor funding that I can tell you more about ringworm infestation than I can about household energy use for solar power. The journey is not linear and it's not hypothesis driven. I could always probably find links back, and this is a thought that I'd been having quite recently, about 2 days ago, looking at the work I'm doing right now. The field of study right now could technically be called transdisciplinary innovation, but we wouldn't be doing dissertation or doctoral study if we weren't looking to expand it or go beyond it. So, transgressing disciplinary boundaries. Let me explain where I've reached now in my work, and I think we could see how it goes back to the beginning, or it reflects the past 15 years. Where I found myself right now, I call it transdisciplinary because that's a field of study, transdisciplinary research that's well established now. It's recognized. It allows me to depart from that point. But I don't know if it can contain the way I'm seeing the challenges in knowledge co-production with the type of populations I have worked with so long. So let me see if I can use examples to explain what I'm talking about. As part of my dissertation, I did a project in 2020 remotely, which basically looked at participatory innovation activity with vegetable vendors in Nairobi's informal settlements, facilitated by young members of their own community who were remotely given training over Zoom in the basics of, you know, the design process, the need to experiment, how to do group work, innovation facilitation, even use of things we take for granted, sticky notes, flip charts, just to get people talking about the problems they were facing at the onset of the pandemic and its restrictions, because it really hit the informal sector the hardest. And it really hit the urban one particularly hard because they didn't have the farms to fall back on for their livelihoods or for survival. So during this activity process, what I discovered, and this is what's created this shift or rethinking of where I'm at and what is transdisciplinarity or transgressing boundaries, is it wasn't simply a matter of I needed translators or I needed local team. That's what I thought when I entered. Okay, these kids in their 20s, you know, I mean, of course, I had partners for this project. So the team was from a nonprofit that does community journalism training for young people in Nairobi's informal settlements, K Youth Media. So this was their 2020 cohort of six young people. Initially, it was, oh, we just need someone to implement and try this sequence of three workshops, because it was a constructive design research. It was a social design initiative. This was an experiment. Could we, in fact, introduce some of these things that we take for granted in innovation, how to come up with ideas, how to navigate a problem space, some tools for helping you facilitate solutions, some to triage them. If you wanted to figure out where to invest first, and then a couple of tools I had developed based on my own work with the informal sector and the prepaid stuff on how to manage money, cash flows, investments in your own perishable produce in an environment of volatility and uncertainties. A couple of tools I built for that, separate conversations. But what I discovered was it wasn't just a matter of, okay, I'm going to train these six guys in the sequence of activities of these three workshops, and then they go implement it for me and record everything on video. Because let's just take brainstorming, okay? Even if you convert it into Swahili, what does it mean? Nothing. Unless you know the intent of things that we take for granted, whether it's jargon, whether it's our academic terminology, whether it's innovation terminology, specialized knowledge, or whether, as I'm coming to discover, it's the gap between the Western knowledge system and local traditional indigenous knowledge, or between knowledge systems. We had to transcend boundaries of epistemology, ontology, axiology, cosmology, because we had to unpack each design technique, tool, method selected for a particular workshop. Let's say a simple thing, we don't need to think about it as all of us. Let's do a workshop, all of us talk about what are the problems we faced with the pandemic, and then cluster them thematically by problems that are outside our control to problems that are inside our control, right? I'm not going to have to explain to you what is a post-it, how would I use it, what's a flip chart, when should it be used, how do you move post-its from one side of external to internal, and the activity that you're facilitating, how do you translate that for the group of mamas, the vegetable vendors? Guys, we're going to brainstorm means nothing, even in Swahili. And the kids were so smart, and their questions were forcing me to dive into the first principles of each of these, because they had to make the activity happen. So a lot of learning. And yes, this is a 10,000 word paper and I can send it to you. It's under review. But what was happening was it wasn't just translation, or it wasn't even interpretation. It was, we drill all the way into first principles. What is the function and nature of this activity? What is its intent? When should it be used? And that's what allowed them to run the program in their own language amongst a group, most of whom had not even completed 4 or 5 years of basic education, right? So we're talking about, in innovation, it's called a two-step flow of information, it's boundary spanning work. So that's where I'm sitting at right now. I'm talking not just transcending boundaries of disciplines in epistemic integration by bringing in scientists and non-scientists, but it looks like we are transcending boundaries of knowledge systems, because these people are not conditioned or familiar with the Western knowledge system in the first place.
Thank you so much. And this is so fascinating to like hear these experiences. And I mean, I feel like it's, you know, there's that saying that, you know, if something's really brilliant, it should seem obvious, like anybody could think of it, but they didn't. Like these approaches that you're talking about on a certain level seem like they're so fundamentally obvious. But I'm curious, like in terms of this, like Western knowledge, meeting indigenous knowledge, like how is this sort of being picked up around? I mean, is this spreading out? Like, I was very interested to hear, like with Nokia, especially thinking of my own research, and one of the biggest issues around like platforms and data being that they are so like Western centric. Have you seen this like spreading out? Is this getting picked up?
You could say on one level, I think all of us here in Finland would be happy to hear you're crediting Nokia with this. Maybe the phone certainly has something to do with this, and the spread of the phone certainly has something to do with Nokia. But this move or this convergence between Western knowledge system and indigenous knowledge system predates all of us here today. The biggest movement has come from sustainability sciences and the climate-related sciences, everything to do with the health and well-being of our natural living environment, the land, the planet itself. Of course, I'm speaking as someone who's speaking about this from outside the specialty areas. So in advance, I would say the disclaimers of if I articulate this incorrectly, and somebody who's listening is a specialist, please forgive me. But broadly speaking, what I've understood is working closely with local traditional indigenous knowledges has become a critical recognition at the level of the UN, the IPCC, the IPBS, everything, every area you can think of. The recognition that a lot of the problems that we face today are partly due to the way the Western knowledge system was originally conceptualized and structured. One, the separation of mind and body. Two, the separation of nature and culture. Three, the positioning of man at the top of a denatured living environment. And the subsequent dehumanization of who could be man, or who could be human, rather. All of these things have the same seeds. And this, I think, is what's driving a much larger movement. I have probably come only very lately to it from the perspective of the informal economy or the informal economic system in the East African context.
Wow, thank you so much. And I mean, this is such a huge thing, and I wish that we had more time to be able to dig into this, but we've been taking up a lot of your time on this lovely afternoon, and we're so grateful for it. But at the end of every episode, we like to do something.
Are we going to do that today?
Same way we do it every time. It's time
Oh,
for the question time. At the end of every episode, we like to ask our guests the question. It's a call to action for our listeners. They're listening to this fascinating conversation and they want to be able to do something. It could be reading something, it could be thinking about something, it could be doing something in their daily lives. But is there anything that you could recommend for our listeners that they could do to get more engaged with these various topics that we've brought up?
I'm inspired in my answer by one of my master's thesis workers. She's a textile artist, and she's moved into tactile knowledge production as a means to reconnect with a sense of the vitality of nature. Her background is European. She's Finnish, French, Swedish, Finnish. And in her thesis research, this is how we came to realize the tracing of the Western knowledge system's denaturing of nature has robbed her of a sense of vitality of the living environment. So her experiments with attempting to reconnect with a sense of the vitality of our natural environment were with moss, by going into moss, touching it, and then trying to recreate that tactile sense with embroidery. So breaking the boundaries not only of how we collect data, numbers, words, and how we interpret data as framed in the Western knowledge system, we are drawing from Robin Wall Kimmerer, a Native American biologist, her book Gathering Moss, on moving beyond that limited way of knowing of the mind and body and extending further senses, emotions, feelings, tactility in the case of Eileen's work, and the spirit. So what I would ask is, if all we know is through our mind and through numbers and through words, then what is it that you could do to push beyond that into other ways of knowing? Is it tapping into intuition? Is it tapping into emotion as a data gathering device? Is it tapping into some kind of embodied knowledge like Eileen is doing? But whatever it is that breaks us from our daily 8 to 10 hours a day, only looking at numbers and words.
Numbers and words have taken on such importance in modernity. And I really appreciate this answer that you've given to the question and really highlighting these other ways of knowing. And wow, does that project sound so interesting, trying to embroider the tactile experience of moss. Like, ooh, I have chills. But yeah, this is all just so amazing. And as Christopher said earlier, I feel like we've barely scratched the surface of what is obviously, or what could be, a much, much longer conversation. But we are so grateful to you for coming on here, talking to us, and giving us some insight into, as I said at the top, this whole subject area that is definitely new for us, but very, very interesting.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on. And I mean, we'd love to have you back on in the future to get into this even more, because there are so many different directions we can go in.
Thank you so much, Christopher and Sophia, for having me on.
A huge thank you again to Neeti Bhan for coming on and sharing her rich experience and insights in this fascinating area of human-centered design and transdisciplinary innovation. Please join us next month when we're going to be speaking with Khalil Avi Betz-Heinemann about his work related to how humans interact with quote-unquote pest species and the new RESET project at University of Helsinki. From the surprisingly warm autumn of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sophia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.